Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. As is always, we start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. Microsoft is cutting 5,000 jobs from the Wichita Business Journal by the Puget Sound Business Journal. Microsoft said last week it will cut 5,000 jobs over the next 18 months, including 1,400 immediately, and announced earnings will be well below previous estimates. It is the biggest layoff in the company's history. The job cuts will range across the company's research and development, marketing, sales, finance, legal, human resources, and information technology departments. The job cuts, which have been rumored in recent days, vastly exceed the sporadic layoffs Microsoft has made over the years, usually a few hundred employees. Chris Liddell, Microsoft's chief financial officer, said slow sales of software and PCs have forced the company to cut expenses, and he took the usual step of not offering revenue or profit estimates for the rest of the fiscal year, which ends June 30, 2009. Quote from Liddell, "Economic activity and IT spend slowed beyond our expectations in the quarter, and we acted quickly to reduce our cost structure and mitigate its impact." "We are not immune to the effects of the economy," said Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer in a statement. For the second quarter, Microsoft said revenue rose to $16.6 billion from $16.4 billion in 2007. Net income fell to $4.2 billion, or 47 cents per share, from $4.7 billion, or 50 cents per share, a year earlier. Analysts polled by Thomson Financial Network expected second quarter revenue of $17.1 billion and earnings of 49 cents per share. Citing the volatility of market conditions, Microsoft said it won't provide revenue and earnings guidance for the rest of the fiscal year. "We are planning for economic uncertainty to continue through the remainder of the fiscal year, almost certainly leading to lower revenue and earnings for the second half relative to the previous year," said Chris Liddell, Microsoft's chief financial officer, in a statement. Moving over to the Troubled Assets Relief Program, we know that Professor Elizabeth Warren, who is really the main inspiration for this particular show, is also the person who is in charge of the panel overseeing the TARP program analysis and concerns. And the panel's initial concerns about TARP have only grown, exacerbated by the shifting explanation of its purposes and the tools used by the Treasury. So Professor Warren has said it is not enough to say that the goal is the stabilization of the financial markets and the broader economy. That goal is widely accepted. The question is how the infusion of billions of dollars to an insurance conglomerate or a credit card company advances both the goal of financial stability and the well-being of taxpayers, including homeowners threatened by foreclosure, people losing their jobs, and families unable to pay their credit cards. It would be constructive for the Treasury to clearly identify the types of institutions it believes fall under the purview of EESA and which do not, and the appropriate uses of TARP funds. The need for Treasury to address these fundamental issues of strategy has only intensified since our last report. Again, that's Professor Warren asking more questions about TARP. Now, it seems that the Bank of America didn't really appreciate the unexpected $15.4 billion fourth quarter loss by Merrill Lynch because its former CEO, John Tane, has been shown the door. Tane, who in September negotiated the sale of Merrill with the Bank of America CEO Kenneth Lewis, agreed his situation was not working out and that he should resign, according to Robert Stickler, a Bank of America spokesman. Bank of America has been taking a lot of heat for purchasing Merrill Lynch, a deal that forced Bank of America to ask for a second multi-billion-dollar investment from the government as it absorbed the mounting losses at the New York-based investment bank, said the AP. The Wall Street Journal is even speculating that the Bank of America and Citigroup may have nationalized. But for all you people who are into basics, grassroots, down-to-earth purchasing, just figure this one out. Merrill Lynch CEO Tane spent $1.2 million on his office when he was moved over to Bank of America's office suite. He used Michael S. Smith to design it. When he became Merrill Lynch's CEO in early 2008, he hired Michael S. Smith Design to revamp his office suite, spending approximately $1.22 million, according to documents. Additionally, documents show that Tane signed off on the purchases personally and that he used another $5,000 to pay expenses Smith incurred in doing the work. The following is a list of some of the items in his suite. An area rug at almost $88,000, a mahogany pedestal table at $26,000, a 19th century credenza at $68,000, pendant light furniture at $19,000, four pairs of curtains at $28,000, a pair of guest chairs at $88,000, a George IV chair at $18,500, six wall sconces at $3,000, a parchment waste can at $1,400, a Roman shade fabric at $11,000, Roman shades at $7,000, coffee table at $6,000, and commode on legs for $35,000. Tane had hired Smith, whose celebrity client list includes Steven Spielberg, Michelle Pfeiffer, Cindy Crawford, and Sir Evelyn de Rothschild, to design his Manhattan apartment at 740 Park Avenue and his 14-bedroom home in Rye, New York. Smith, by the way, is also Michelle Obama's interior designer, and the White House paid him $100,000 for his services. Tane also paid his driver, catch this one, $230,000 for 1 year's work, which included the driver's $85,000 salary and a bonus of $18,000, and another $128,000 in overtime pay, documents show. Drivers of top executives are usually paid about half that amount. Tane was appointed as Merrill's CEO as the firm suffered massive losses from investments tied to the depressed real estate market under his predecessor, Stan O'Neill, who was ousted in late 2007. The losses continued through 2008, forcing Tane and his management team to sell brokerage firm to Bank of America in mid-September or face near certain liquidation as investors fearing further losses began pulling lines of credit and other financing. And as I said earlier, he's now gone. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now we'll start the second segment of the show, which is more optimistic, pragmatic, and dealing with your debt and financial situation in contrast to what's going on around you. And as I always do, an important credit The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. Their books, which I highly recommend, are All Your Worth, where I get many of the ideas from this show, and The Two Income Trap. In fact, All Your Worth is really the textbook from which this show and all of the preceding 39 shows have found their theories and information. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look up Life in Debt so you can review the shows that I have voiced in the past so you can get a full education. In reviewing what I discussed last week, we're discussing the concept of money and relationships and how using the information, data, and theories of this program, you would be very, very fortunate if you had a willing partner to go along with everything that you need to upgrade your situation on all the levels of bare necessities, of your wants, and of your savings. However, that is quite the perfect idealistic dream, and it usually doesn't happen that way. So what do you do, because you've been following along in the course and you have implemented many of the ideas, if not all of the ideas, and are benefiting by them? So we came up with three basic things that you need to do to continue on in your relationship and actually improve your relationship in spite of the money issues that are often a wedge in a relationship. The first point I discussed was change what you can, and we went over the old serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And so you have to make a promise in terms of not only your money situation, but of your relationship. And that promise is, I will change the things I can. And that means taking action, not just an intellectual position on this, but change everything you possibly can. So some of the basic concepts were, for example, reshopping the insurance, getting those credit cards out of your wallet and using cash, building your security fund, making sure that you have your retirement fund at your job. Make a promise to improve things as much as you can, and that may be all by yourself. Now, you can make significant improvements on your own. It would be easier if your spouse, your partner, your mate came along, but this isn't really about easier. At this point, it's about better. Don't wait for your mate to be perfect. Fix the things you can right here, right now. So that's the first point. The second point is no nagging. And this can be expanded to no nagging, no bitterness, no complaining. It's very easy to get into conflict about money. You can say, how much did you spend? When are you going to get those quotes that you said that you were going to help me with? And the point that you don't like something that's going on and getting intense about it. But you need to give that up right now, because it doesn't work. You can't nag someone into meaningful change, and you sure can't complain your way into a happier relationship. So that's important. This is about making your life better, not about making it worse, and conflict and tension in your relationship is going to make it worse. So that is got to be something that you dispose of. You may say, well, it isn't fair, and you're right. It isn't fair in a specific sense that you're working harder than your mate, but that's not the only issue here. You may have to work harder, particularly at the beginning, and it isn't fair that you spend less or that your debt was mostly your partner's and not yours. So it may not seem fair, but that's really not the issue here. You want to make it smooth. So saying it ain't fair, and every time that does come up, you can either have conflict or you can do something that will bring out a positive trend of thought. Every time "it ain't fair" comes into your mind, think of something you love about your partner. And that's a critical point. They may have a great sense of humor, and they may help people when they're sick. They may take care of the kids. They may be a good cleaner in the house, or a person who is a handy person, etc. They may be very romantic and a good dancer. Whatever it is, that's not my concern. The fact is that fundamentally, much of your relationship is sound. That's why you're in it in the first place. And the finances aren't supposed to be the thing that destroys your relationship or brings out all the negative possible cracks in a relationship and overshadows the good things, because hopefully the good things are a vast majority of that relationship. So you don't want to have the money be the thing that destroys it. Frankly, a deep, intimate relationship isn't just about what's fair. It's about what's good, it's about what's bad, and it's about what makes the thing work. And money is just one part of your relationship. So you have to deal with money with your partner, but there are a lot of other issues. So you don't want to be nagging about the money. You will never succeed if you do it that way. You won't make your relationship any better, any happier, and you won't get any richer. So let go of the complaints, and you'll be a whole lot happier personally, and a whole lot closer to the riches that you are interested in amassing. And then the next and final point that we discussed last week was stick to the subject when you're talking to your partner about money. In essence, what this really means is be specific and more subtle. Don't get into the giant, "it's time to talk about money" conversations, the bombs that you're going to drop on them about what they are doing wrong. And this could be very, very important in keeping the relationship working together happily and functionally. Especially, of course, if you want to get over the money difficulties that you are having. So this is particularly important if you're the kind of a couple that has the tendency to quarrel over money. You don't want to nag the other person about the money. You don't want to complain your mate about the money. But you don't want to put that kind of subtle pressure on them to talk about money and, of course, get into the fray, into the battle about money. The battle over giant abstract issues is not good. You can't start throwing out these generalities. "We need to save more. You need to do this. We have to change that" kind of situation where you're hurling accusations at your partner. You have to pick specific kinds of small topics, and modest topics that is, and try to deal with them. And then when you deal with them, you stay on that topic. You don't shift into any kind of ad hominem attacks. You just deal with some very simple aspects. For example, you say, "I found a good deal on car insurance. What do you think?" You've done the footwork already, and now you are getting them to get on board with you. "I shifted from credit cards to cash, and it's working very well. I think that's a great idea, and I would be willing to stop at the ATM for you too and get you some cash if you need to have cash." So it's a simple, straightforward suggestion, and it should always be one, preferably one, that has a relatively easy answer attached to it. It should be positive, it should be an invitation, and it should be something constructive, not a demand and not an order. It's not coming from the top-down management kind of perspective. You are a team, you're working together, and you see something, but you have to bring them along because you are co-equal. You're not going to be a superior being in the relationship. So in essence, you stay away from the all or nothing territory. What you do is you recognize that you are not going to get a complete reversal from your partner. The change will come, change is inevitable and you have to give it some direction, but that's a little at a time. If you demand 100% or they're not on your side, then you have a battle that will end up in a war. We don't demand complete instantaneous reform. Just one little piece at a time, and that will eventually raise the situation up and bring you to improvement. And that's what this is all about. Because then when you add them all up, these little changes can add up not only to big bucks, but to a more solid and happy relationship. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So continuing with this topic of love and money, I'd like to go into what Professor Warren calls the 8 golden rules of money and relationships. And they are for all kinds of couples, those that are actually getting along very peacefully and those that are bashing at each other. With these rules, you can put them into practice immediately, regardless of what your partner is doing. And you can take the sting out of your money conflicts and find a better way to compromise. So the first rule is, what's mine is ours. I'll repeat that. What's mine is ours. This is a very important concept in ownership in marriage and in partnerships or with your mate. The law actually looks at community property in many states as fundamental, but even outside of those states, when you actually get into the legal framework, you'll see that property mostly is going to be a mutually shared concept. And if it ever came down to a divorce, that is often going to be the case anyway, even in the non-community property states. We'll see that it's not just about what came in financially during the marriage. There's a lot of issues going on. So let's take one example. There are certain people in a marriage or in a long-term relationship where there is a debate about having one bank account or two. And from our perspective, it really doesn't matter how many bank accounts you have. What does matter is how you organize your life practically. You may want to have different file folders, but the idea that just because you have two bank accounts means it's yours and his or hers on the other side, that's not proper. It's not my account, my money, and your money. So the real answer is that for relationships that are long-term, forever kind of relationships, and we're not talking about casual, live-in together kinds of relationships that don't have a long-term commitment to them. In those kinds of relationships, of course, you want to have some boundaries and you want to live separately. That includes finances. For the most part, you're only roommates, as it were. There's not a commitment on all the different levels, which are emotional, spiritual, physical, and financial, to make it work. That's a total commitment for the long-term haul. Now, as I said, if you're living somewhat separate and haven't promised to stay together forever, your money should stay separate too. The bank accounts are separate, the bills are separate, the big decisions are largely separate also in those kinds of relationships. Any financial sharing you agree on is just that. It's an agreement. It's to be negotiated, renegotiated according to the situation. But if you are in this forever category, married, the assets belong to both of you, the debts belong to both of you, and so the money and the decisions about money belongs to both of you. And that's true even of issues coming into the marriage, like student debt from before you were married, and some cash that may come into the marriage before you're married, unless you have some prenuptial agreement that delineates all of that and clarifies it, which could be a side issue anyway. You're looking at a situation where you have put everything together. And just think of that in a practical way. It's not possible for one of you to be poor while the other is rich, and it's not possible for one person to be
going into retirement while the other one is eating out of a garbage can, and one is living in a mansion and the other is living in the street. So in short, you are married and so is your money. And again, as I said, the word marriage in this context means a long-term commitment. So it's nonsense to say, but I earn all the money, or at least most of it, and all my partner does is stay at home and the childcare or the housework or both. And in fact, there's some interesting statistics that show, and this happened many years ago when I first started practicing law, I laughed about it. There was a tort lawyer out of Texas who, in divorce situations, started using specialists to show everything that in that time was the housewife was worth based on what she was doing in all these different kinds of areas. And it turned out that what she was contributing to the marriage financially, if her jobs such as housework and cooking and nursing, child rearing, being a chauffeur, being a consultant, and so on and so forth, were an astronomical sum at the end of the years of marriage that people would have gone through and evaluated only the income as valuable. So you have to think holistically here. You can't divide everything up and set yourself up to be a loser and for the relationship to be a loss. Again, this goes back to the concept of fairness, that fairness is something that you can't put into a localized sense, that the marriage isn't based on fairness in terms of every single category of the marriage. You share everything, you share your home, you share your lives, you share your money, and in the better or worse situation, you share everything, come what may, good or bad. And this is ultimately saying that this relationship in life works out a whole lot better when you pool everything, when you pool the money, and you don't worry too much about yours and mine. So for example, this would translate into a joint checking account under both names. And this is for the principal categories of the bare necessities, which are set, and also the savings, which is set. And money for these categories, it's already budgeted, and those are for all the basic kinds of concepts, and it doesn't really matter that you have two accounts and that you would be squabbling over these preset sums. The wants category and the little purchases, that's a completely separate issue. And as long as you keep your $1,000 cushion in your joint checking account, just in case something doesn't work out, it really doesn't matter. Every month it's going to be going in the same paychecks, coming out the same expenses. And this is a huge part of our program. And that does not mean that separate checking accounts are bad, but if you have them, there are a few conditions that you should meet. One, you both need to know where you stand financially. It's not okay to use separate accounts to keep secrets. Number two, you both must accept 100% responsibility. That means it's not okay to use separate accounts as an excuse for her credit card balance is her problem, or I covered my bills, so why should I worry? The money and the bills still belong to both of you, even if you find it more convenient to manage from separate accounts. And finally, you make the big decisions together. It's perfectly fine to splurge on a new pair of shoes without consulting your mate, and this is in the wants category. But it's not okay to buy a new car or to empty your retirement account without a discussion. You can't agree on the big decisions. That is a problem. So you have to learn to talk about these big decisions until you find a reasonable compromise. Even if you are using separate accounts, you have a joint financial future, which means you need to work together on the plans that will have a major impact on your life. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.